Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Journalist, humorist, novelist, and playwright Calvin Trillin has written about many things. He's written about restaurants, about Donald Trump, the civil rights movement, and his family's penchant for creating home movies, and of course, about his beloved wife, Alice. His recent play is not only for her, but about her. The play is called About Alice, and it's based on a memoir of the same name. It's an intimate portrait of love, illness, and family. The show takes the audience through Calvin and Alice's life together, from their meeting at a party in the early 60s to her death from heart failure in 2001. A longtime presence in Calvin's writing, Alice, a writer, an educator, an advocate in her own right, is a presence on stage at the Theater for a New Audience in Brooklyn. About Alice opens January 20th. It will run through February 3rd, and Calvin Trillin is in studio with us. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So I understand you began writing about Alice at the suggestion of your editor, David Remnick. What did he
That's
say to
right.
you?
Well, he said, have you ever, and he said it in a very tentative way, it was a few years after Alice died, have you ever thought about writing about her? And of course I had, excuse me, I had written thousands of words about her, but sort of in the lighter pieces and about her role in the family as the sensible person in the family. So,
do you need water?
Sorry.
It's okay. Do you need a glass of water?
No, I have one. Thank you.
Okay.
Anyway, so I'm...
She's the sensible one? Can you give me an example of Alice being the sensible one?
Well, it says in some of the food books that she had a weird predilection for limiting our family to three meals a day, although she had a broad interpretation of what constituted an hors d'oeuvre. That's true. And someone said they're like George Burns and Gracie Allen, except she's George and he's Gracie.
Oh, no worries. It's that time of year. Everybody's got something. So at what point after David Remnick suggested this, did you feel like this is something that you would like to do or you felt like you could do?
Well, I thought about it. And I decided I could do it. It's a sort of expanding what I wrote about her and sort of correcting in a way what I wrote about her, because I wanted to write about her as she was, as a real person, and not as George Burns. And so the New Yorker piece was called Alice Off the Page. And then Jeffrey Horowitz from the Theater for New Audience called and said, we have to make some theatrical thing out of this. And so that the two phone calls, what did it?
Well, I know one of your big concerns was you didn't want just your memoir read. You wanted it to actually be a play. So yeah. How did you make that transition in terms of
writing? I mean, there are successful sort of one-person monologues of books. I mean, Joan Didion's book was done that way. But it didn't interest me much because I'd already written that. And so I thought it would be worth trying to do something else. But so that started a long process. Mm-hmm. And of course, I'm used to working by myself. The pace of the theater is somewhat different. I've compared it to trying to cross a swimming pool that's full of strawberry jello. It tries the patience sometimes. But however, there are wonderful sides to collaboration. I mean, that some actor can make your words come alive, or the costume person can go through the clothes I have from Alice and talk to the people who used to sell those clothes and figure out. I mean, it's wonderful to have all these kind of support groups when the play actually happens. But it's a long journey.
You've described Alice as your co-writer of this play.
Right.
How is she your co-writer?
Well, it's a two-character play, and the characters sometimes talk to each other and sometimes talk to the audience. Mm-hmm. And virtually everything she says in speeches to the audience is from her writing or her articles or her letters to the girls. We have two daughters. And so when she talks about cancer, she's talking from a piece she wrote for the New England Journal of Medicine. And sometimes when she talks about what she's telling the girls about something, it's from a letter she wrote. Mm. She wrote letters.
Letters are great.
Yeah, we don't have any more, but they're nice. They were nice, I should say.
They were nice. They're lovely things for family members to find later.
Yeah,
they really are.
Yeah, a lot of hers are in this envelope she kept that she had written important stuff on the outside.
Is that what she wrote on the outside?
Yeah,
important stuff.
And so there are copies of letters of the girls and some of the things the girls have written her, and occasionally a poem that I wrote for her.
Well, that's accurately titled on the envelope, then, I think.
Yeah, important stuff.
Important stuff. We're talking to Calvin Trillin about the play About Alice. It's going to be running at the theater for a new audience from January 20th to February 3rd. What was it about Alice that you wanted to capture on stage, that you hoped would be captured on stage?
Well, in general, the difference between a memoir and a play, it seemed to me, was, you know, there's an old writing course motto, show, don't tell. Mm-hmm. And when you write a memoir, you're pretty much telling things. And a play, I thought, it could show her speaking her own words. And as a person who had something to say, and a substantial person, it's different from just writing what she said, but mm-hmm. having her say it makes a big difference. So I wanted to show that.
And you can tell from the play and from some of her she was a very good writer.
She was a good writer. I used to say, saying that she's a better writer than I am, while true, was rude.
But she also was your editor, though. You've said this in many interviews, that she was the person who read your work first.
Yeah.
When she did edit you, which is never a lot of fun for a writer, when somebody comes and says, this could be good, but you should maybe do this, what was she trying to help you with? Was there something that reoccurring that she said, Calvin, you must think about this. Calvin, what if you tried this?
She didn't do that so much as tell me what didn't work. And an older writer at The New Yorker told me fairly early on, you don't want to have your wife read the rough drafts. It'll ruin a marriage, because any time any writer hands over a rough draft to somebody, even a rough draft he knows is pretty weak, what he wants to hear is, brilliant.
Fabulous. You're on to something.
Don't change a word.
Yeah.
So it's a test. But the thing is she was honest, and also she was experienced in this. I mean, she used to copy edit books at Random House, and she taught English and English composition. And I compare her to a high-powered Wall Street lawyer, and I was the pro bono case. So it's hard to pass up that kind of advice. And other people gave her things to read. We had a friend who gave her a 1,600-page novel.
Sure, that's a friend?
she suggested some cuts.
I don't know if that's a friend who shows up with a 1,600-page novel at your house. I'm talking to Calvin Trillin about the play he's written About Alice. It's currently at the Theater for a New Audience in Brooklyn. Going to be January 20th, it starts. There's also, we talk about Alice's, her essence, her personality coming through. There's also this great love story between the two of you. And you, in the play, you talk about when young people ask how you met, you say, go to a party. Walk into the right party.
Yeah, wander into the right party.
Wander into the right party. Yeah. What party did you wander into?
This was a party given by Monocle magazine, which was a doomed magazine of political satire. And I used to write for them in some, even though their pay was so low that they once sent me a bill for a piece. They said they weren't processing. It was going to cost more than they had intended to pay me. And as Monocle sort of faded financially, the parties got bigger. And Alice's theory was that they were there to get people married. And there were several marriages that came out of people connected with Monocle. Hmm. And when everybody got married, they folded. And
their job was done. Their work was done.
Their job of work was done. That's right. And they. So, and I told Victor Novasky, who was the editor, that his enterprise was more successful as a marriage brokerage than as a magazine. But it did get a lot of people married.
During the course of the play, we learn about you. We learn about your daughters. How did they feel about the play and you writing the play?
They're okay with it. I, of course, showed it to them and said, if there's anything that you don't want in here, just tell me. But they had written about things themselves, and I sort of quit writing about them in the family stuff when they were about maybe 10 or 11. I didn't exactly make a policy, but it just seemed natural not to. I figured the last thing a teenage girl needs is some wry comments by her father. I have enough on her plate already. So I really hadn't written about them, and there's some things about them in the play, but they're fine with it. They've seen stage readings. They haven't seen the play yet.
In the play, a few times, Calvin, Alice sort of tells us to the audience that you're embellishing a little bit.
Yes.
How much embellishment actually takes place?
Well, for instance, I mentioned Alice's rule about class plays, that if your child is in a class play and you don't go to every single performance, including the special Thursday matinee for the fourth grade, the county will come and take the child. Alice thought that was embellishing. But she was, and actually I sort of agree, mm-hmm. class play was sort of put on earth partly to give parents a chance to show their priorities. So if you can get to every performance, it's a good idea.
Over the course of the play, we get to know you, we get to know her. We know it's her family backstory, which is quite interesting and
right.
really, I think, informs how she decides she's going to create a family and how you're going to create a family right. together. And then her illness comes into the equation. What role did the illness play in your marriage? Was it just a terrible intruder? Was it sometimes people could become closer?
Well, it was certainly a terrible intruder, but I think after she first operated on for lung cancer in 1976, but I think after a few years, we quit thinking about it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And she had another scare in 1990, but she lived till 2001. So I'm not sure it had that much impact at the beginning or mm-hmm. after a few years. It was hard not to think about it for the first couple of years. But I think it usually does draw people closer.
Mm-hmm.
The girls really weren't old. The girls were 4 and 7 when she originally got sick, so
that's
they
young.
Were sort of not in the loop, so they didn't know what was going on for a while. So I think it had a kind of a limited impact until she really got sick.
As you look back on that time, in the play, she seems incredibly brave.
Right.
Was she during that time?
Yeah.
Yeah, did she show vulnerability in any way? Because it didn't appear that way on the stage, but we've all
seen. I don't think so.
You don't? Really? Wow. That's exceptional.
When she when there was the time she had the scare in 1990, when this bone scans seemed to indicate there might be a tumor on her spine, she said the first thing she did was make an appointment for a haircut, because she didn't want to look pathetic and sick-like to the doctors, so they wouldn't condescend and put her in what she called the land of the sick.
There's wisdom in that, though.
Yeah, there was wisdom in a lot of things she said about that. And her, who she was, she said, had a lot to do with what she looked like. And she thought that the most important thing to concentrating on when you were had a life-threatening illness was not how much to change, but how much to stay the same. And the worst thing the cancer could do was rob you of your identity. And part of her identity was what she looked like. So she was pretty straightforward about all of it.
One of your readers once wrote that when she looked at her boyfriend, she wondered, quote, will he love me like Calvin loves Alice? How do you feel about being a symbol for inspirational love?
Well, I was sort of surprised. I thought that the this was after, I guess, the piece in The New Yorker. And I thought it was a piece about Alice. And then some people thought it was a piece about marriage and love. And I remember one interviewer said, what did you think about being reviewed as someone who was in touch with his feminine self? And I said, all I could think of was maybe some of the guys I went to high school with are going to read that, and I'm going to be in trouble. But I was surprised that they could take what had been sort of sitcom writing and realize how I felt about her. But some of them didn't seem surprised at all.
About Alice is currently in previews at the theater for a new audience at the Polanski Shakespeare Center in Brooklyn. Opening date is set for January 20th. Calvin Trillin, thank you for joining us on All of It.
Thank you, Allison.
When we come back, we'll talk to the director behind Poland's entry to this year's Academy Awards, a sweeping romantic film with the Cold War as a backdrop. Don't go away. All of It will be back after a quick break. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Cold War is the story of star-crossed lovers who meet while forming a musical group to showcase folk music in Poland. But soon pressures, including directives from the Polish government, for their group to perform propaganda push the lovers apart and into different countries, leading to a cycle of reunion and separation. The movie finds its protagonists in Berlin, Yugoslavia, and Paris in the 1950s, set against the backdrop of the Iron Curtain. It so far received widespread acclaim. Its director, Pawu Pawlikowski, picked up an award for Best Director at Cannes. The New York Film Critics Circle awarded Best Language Film. It is a favorite to be nominated in the foreign language category at the Oscars. Pawu Pawlikowski joins me in studio now to talk about his film Cold War, which he directed and co-wrote. Pawu, welcome to All of It.
Thank you for having me.
You dedicate this film to your parents, and the main characters have their names. Tell me a little bit about how your parents inspired this film, Cold War.
But they've been a presence all my life. I'm the only child, and they were like the most important people in my life. And at the same time, they were a kind of disastrous couple who kept falling apart, quarreling, betraying each other, abandoning each other, marrying other people, marrying again, remarrying. So I've lived with this drama for many years. And after they died in 1989, just before the wall came down, just before mm-hmm. the Cold War ended, I was left with this big vacuum, which was kind of growing year after year, and I kind of realized, you know, there's sort of some sort of unfinished business. And what's more, it's such an amazing story when you step back and look at it, an amazing love story, which well, most of the time didn't look like a love story, but by the end of it, after 40 years of this kind of chaos, and toing and froing, it became a very touching and moving couple. So for many years I've been kind of trying to write it up in some way, and the more I looked at it, the less sense it made and the more complicated it got. But 5-6 years ago, around the time I worked on Ida, and just after I finished Ida, in fact, I kind of thought, okay, let's forget that it's my parents, you know, let's just kind of create a kind of simplify it, create a different couple, analogous, similar in the spirit of, but not literally them. And then it became quite easy to just write a story which doesn't take 40 years, as in their case, but 15 years. And story which also has a music as a key element, which wasn't the case with them. So the spirit of my parents hovers over it, and that relationship is so affected and defined by the Cold War and the situation, you know, the political situation in Poland, but also the situation in exile, which they both went through. So it just became a very kind of strong love story with layers to it and full of ambiguities.
As you were growing up, did you keep journals? Did you keep notes about your parents? Or did that information, did you sit down and think about it as an adult?
Of course, I remember practically all the dramatic bits, you know, mm-hmm. the big gaps because they weren't there all the time and they, you know, for periods, one of them disappeared. But I remembered all the kind of key moments. But it's only once I kind of divorced myself from the idea that it's literally them that I could, right. my imagination could, you know, take off and actually invent some stuff that was actually more dramatically coherent or interesting and something that, in a situation that could be told visually, graphically, in a condensed way. So I forgot in the end that it's about them. You know, I just kind of started plotting it as if it was just a good situation, good characters that I'm sculpting with.
So them as the catalyst, and then the creativity took over.
Exactly.
So it's not a documentary, it's a creative enterprise.
Exactly, and I would have been much too inhibited to actually, you know, if I was thinking that it's really them.
So it's Victor and Zula. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah.
Okay. On the website, the summary says that it's fatefully mismatched yet condemned to each other. So what is at the heart of this relationship?
Well, it changes at different points, you know. At the beginning, it's a kind of fascination by two characters who are totally different from different social background, different temperament. He's 10 years older. So in her eyes, he's a kind of authority figure. Then quite soon, he loses that position. then, you know, when they get together, you know, the relationship changes, but it's kept together by, you know, sensuality, music, sex, I suppose. Then a lot of the relationship depends on them not being together and building each other up in their imagination. I mean, they spend 3 years apart from each other. You know, she doesn't leave with him to the West, and sometimes when somebody's absent, you know, they actually become much more powerful in your imagination than they ever were. And then you have a moment when you finally meet this person and they kind of a bit disappointing and, you know, what the hell was I thinking? And then, you know, there's so many moments and layers in that relationship where you come together and you kind of, and you repel each other at the same time. But there's one point, you know, in this story and also in my parents' story, where you realize that after all that stuff that happened, after all these toings and froings, you have history with this person, and mm-hmm. it's the only person who's there for you. In the country's changed, politics change, history moves on, and yet there's this one other person in life that belongs to your story. That is the other half, as it were. And at the end of all this turmoil, you know, they really discover that they have only each other, and it's a very tender, beautiful ending. And I wanted to show this love story that doesn't look like a love story throughout, but in the end, by the end of the day, you can say, God, that was an amazing love story.
You're speaking with Pavel Pavlovsky about his film Cold War. I love the scene when they first encounter each other. Zula is auditioning for this music group, and she's got such sass, yeah. and sort of a sense of self. Can you describe that audition?
Yes,
see,
I mean,
it's a
she,
great scene. You know who she is right away.
Yeah, it was a real shortcut, wasn't it? Yeah, she turns up at this, for this audition for children from the countryside who was supposed to be talented at singing and dancing. And she's not from the countryside. She hasn't got a song to sing. So she kind of borrows a song from a girl sitting next to her and in fact joins her in that song and makes it like a song for two voices. And basically cons her way into this into this ensemble. And then when she's actually asked to sing something that she had prepared, it turns out it's an aria from a Soviet musical, Stalin's favorite musical, in fact. It was called Jolly Fellows, which is totally the wrong thing to be singing at an audition for a folk ensemble. And it also, especially with Viktor and Irena, his colleague who has founded the folk ensemble, they'd hate a Soviet musical, you know, it's the last thing you should have performed in front of them. So, but you can see her thinking on her feet. I mean, she's a real survivor, and she, you know, she's quick.
And he's taken with her.
Well, she's got this kind of spark, this energy that he obviously responds to, that he himself maybe lacks.
And this folk group, is this based on a actual folk group?
It's inspired by a folk group called Mazowsze. There are a couple of big folk ensembles, state folk ensembles in Poland, Mazowsze and Śląsk. This one I based on Mazowsze, and I did quite a lot of research. Plus, Mazowsze was around at the time when I was growing up in Poland. You know, it was the kind of state-sponsored folk music. We used to call it fake lore, you know, as opposed to folklore, and kind of detested it because they were pushing it.
Because it was forced on you, right?
It was forced on you. They tried not to play jazz or rock, or, you know, they were just kind of, the radio was full of this kind of, you know, the people's music. You know. And at the same time, these songs were rather beautiful. So when so they kind of stay with you, you know, a bit like, maybe you resented listening to ABBA in the 70s and you listen to it now. Some of these songs are brilliant.
I love them.
So when I re-listened to that stuff, you know, maybe 10 years ago, I thought that was really beautiful. Plus I heard it live, you know, performed live. It's got real power to it. So it's Mazowsze was the name of this folk ensemble. It was formed in 1949, just like in the film, by a couple who went around the countryside, collected folk music and kind of used, you know, transformed them into something more arranged and choreographed. Then quite quickly in the early 50s, they were co-opted by the Ministry of Culture, the Stalinist Ministry of Culture, who decided that this is exactly our people's music and we're going to promote it. It's going to be the visiting card for our country. And it's the kind of music we want to represent our country, none of that kind of decadent Western nonsense, jazz or atonal music. So and that kind of is recreated in the film. You can see the moment when the Minister of Culture kind of co-opts the thing and forces them to change the repertoire a bit. So all that is quite close to the original Mazowsze. Also the fact that on the first foreign tour to the West, you know, people defected or one person defected, you know, that gave me the idea that it actually was quite a good vehicle to, if you wanted to get out of the country, you know, you join a folk ensemble. And I used some of the songs from the repertoire of Mazowsze, the real folk ensemble. The three main tunes, in fact, Dwa serduszka, cztery oczy, which keeps cropping up in different versions, and Oberek Opoczyński, and another song called Dolina, Dolina, which becomes Lendetwa later on. So I basically used three tunes from the repertoire, turned them at the beginning of the film into kind of primitive source music by asking musicians that I found around the country to perform it in their way, make it sound authentic, authenticated. Then I used the Mazowsze version at the premiere of Mazurek's performance in Warsaw. And then I asked a jazz musician friend of mine to do a jazz version of these three tunes, a kind of bebop number first of the Oberek, and then these kind of jazzy chansons that Joanna Kulik sings so beautifully, in first in Polish and in French.
It's so interesting to hear you speak about music because you speak about it with great passion, but you're in this visual medium. Did your feelings about music and your feelings about it with the story were they always together, or did one come first? Story, music, music, story, or are they just married?
They're married, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's very, very difficult to say where one thing starts and the other one ends, you know. But I, you know, my idea of filmmaking is that image making, sound, music, performance, it all comes together. And if you can blur all the lines, then the film starts to work.
You mentioned your film Ida before. Is there a connection between these two films in your mind?
Well, only in so far as they mine Polish history and landscapes of the, you know, Ida in the 60s, early to mid 60s. Cold War is from 49 to 64. Plus, I suppose I used the same, but well, I used the Academy format, which you know both share, and both are shot in black and white. For different reasons, mind you. Ida is shot in black and white because I wanted it to be a kind of slightly abstract, meditative, prayer-like piece, and very stripped down. Whereas Cold War is a much more dynamic, much more punchy, you know, as the title suggests, you know, it's about conflict, about passion. So the black and white is much more contrasty, and the camera work is very different. There's much more, there's movement in it. You know, Ida, the camera didn't move. But I suppose to an outsider they might look similar, you know, the kind of boxy format and black and white.
I just wonder from your point of view. I mean, it doesn't matter from the outsider's
point of view.
Basically,
it's just going back in time, you know. I mean, it's basically mining Polish or my family history and my memories and the memories of my parents, you know. So so it's kind of working an area which fascinates me, which is some kind of unfinished business, which explains, you know, why I am where I am, why Poland is what it is, you know, who my parents were. All that I find, you know, in the second half of my life more and more interesting.
Well, given what's going on with Poland now, with right-wing politics, would you ever consider making a contemporary film?
Yeah,
about
God, you know, I mean,
politics?
You switch on the TV and it's already it's already a film. Like,
it's already
a
right.
kind of grotesque comedy mainly. But no, it's very difficult to get a handle on the present day, you know. I find it very... I used to make documentaries, but documentary is another genre. Mm-hmm. I used to make documentaries in the 80s and early 90s. And but these days, you know, so much happens in the media, in the world of media, in the digital sphere. It's very difficult to capture that film-wise. And we're going through a period which is impossible to understand. I think it'll take a decade for us to get a handle on what's actually going on now, you know, this civilizational change. Mm-hmm. And I'm not just talking about right-wing politics. I'm talking about, you know, the digital civilization. And right-wing populism is part of it. It's not like a... It's a reaction to it, but it's also... It also wouldn't happen without this digital civilization that you know, shapes our thinking and makes us follow the most simplistic narratives so readily. Present day is difficult. Mind you, Poland is not the only country where strange things are happening, and at the same time, you know, it's not. As I said, it's not clear what's going on. You know, it's not all lost. You know, I think we shouldn't lose our nerve. We should just kind of do our own thing and make sure we don't give in to populism and don't give in to simplifying history, and just at least in films, in art, try to show how complicated and beautiful and paradoxical reality can be.
Well, that's why the arts are more important now than ever. It's the only place where there's nuance these days.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, we should keep that area free of ideology and of media too, you know. And it's not just ideology that's the problem. It's this general tendency towards the lowest common denominator, towards this, you know, total simplification of everything.
What's your next project?
I'm not entirely sure. I thought I knew, but but these last... it's been such a kind of...
So honest, I don't know.
Well, I have a couple of things, but I just... when the dust settles, you know, I'm on this kind of promotional tour, which is very, you know, very time-consuming, and it really kind of messes with your brain, so it's kind of difficult to see straight. So, we'll see.
You just need some quiet time.
I need to switch off for a while, yeah.
Where do you go for that time?
I go to a Greek island, probably, you know, which I haven't been to for a while, but there's a place I go to just kind of to cut off from everything.
Well, safe travels to there. I look forward to whatever it is you come up with next.
Thank you.
My guest has been Pavo Pavlikovsky. The name of the film is Cold War. Thanks for being on All of It. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We are very excited about our collaboration with the Academy of American Poets. Over the course of the year, we will be hearing from the curators of Poem a Day, an original series that sends a poem each and every day to your inbox when you sign up on its site. The poems reach more than 500,000 readers when they get up in the morning and click their email. This month's curator for Poem a Day is poet T.C. Tolbert, the poet laureate of Tucson, Arizona. Tolbert is a self-described genderqueer feminist poet and teacher committed to social justice. He joins us now for a conversation about teaching, writings, and all things poetry. Hi, TC.
Hey, how are you doing?
I am doing great. I love Tucson, by the way. Great town.
Oh, well, it's the warmest winter.
And some of the prettiest mountains.
That's right.
So you've talked about bringing poetry to people that as your job. And it is your job. Mm. So why do you think it's important for people to read poetry?
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of great reasons to read poetry, but what I notice the most in my own reading and that of my students and people who interact with poems is that it slows us down and allows us to really be changed by what might seem like a small experience that becomes expansive very quickly.
When someone wants to approach poetry and they want to engage with it more, but they're really not sure how to start, what advice would you give them?
This is what I love actually about this project, the Poem a Day, mm-hmm. is that starting with any poem from kind of any book is the best place to start. Just pick one up. And I think if we slow down and read a poem, engaging with the language as it is on the page without having expectations of what it's going to do, that to me is the exciting part about it, and how a poem can become this this gift right in front of me as it begins to sort of unfold. You know, when I sit down and read essays or stories, I may not know how the plot is going to necessarily turn, but I know that there will be turns in the plot, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And in a poem, I really don't know what is going to change, and I get to be surprised and delighted almost at every turn. So for me, that is... I think if folks sit down with a poem and can approach it with that openness and say, I think I know what language is supposed to do, but I don't know how this poem is going to take off, and just follow it. So I think approaching it with a sense of curiosity is the best way to begin reading poems.
Who are some of the first poets to really move you?
Well, I'd say the first poet that I remember feeling changed by is Maureen Seaton. And I have to admit, I was much older than we often hear the story of, well, I started writing poems when I was 6 years old, or something like that. And I did, but the poem that truly changed the trajectory of my life is a poem called Fiddleheads. And I read that when I was 21 years old. And it was the first time that I was, which I'm sure we'll get into in a bit, I was a lesbian at the time, or coming out as a lesbian. And that was the first time that I saw a representation of queer love in a poem. Mm-hmm. And it really felt like it made my life possible.
Well, one way to talk about this, which is great, is the signature in your email, TC. It says, TC Tolbert, he/him/his, and I truly love being called Hey Girl. And in writing, it's S/he. Isn't language amazing?
It is, isn't it?
That is a great signature. Tell our listeners about the signature and why you have that at the end of your email, why it's important to you.
Well, part of it is to just sort of let folks know, so it's informative. But I also chose to explain as much as I did there because I want to get at the nuance and the expansiveness of my gendered experience in a way that, you know, an initial meeting of anyone really could never do. Mm-hmm. We just make so many assumptions about people and gender in particular so quickly and sort of check that off the list and move forward. And similar to the way that I approach poems, I think gender can be this, expansive, exciting terrain that we get to really pay attention to and learn new things from, instead of needing to just, okay, I understand it, moving forward, let's move on. So I do think language is amazing, and I think people are amazing, and I like the opportunity to get that little note in there at the bottom of each email.
Well, let's expand on that a little bit, and we can do it through poetry. I'd love for you to read us one of your own poems, which is called Dear Melissa. Can you tell our listeners about Melissa?
Sure. So, my name now is TC, and that comes from a nickname, Tiger Cakes, people are like, that's really your name? It is. But I was given that name when I hiked the Appalachian Trail. Prior to that, my name was Melissa. So that was the name that, my parents gave me when I was born. And when I started my transition, which I want to sort of bookmark and say, I feel like is an ongoing transition. I don't really ever feel like I'll get to the end of it. But when I started, I felt really clear that Melissa and that name had brought me to this point. Like, she had sort of shepherded me to that place in my life. And there are a lot of trans folks for whom their previous names are, they don't feel good. But for me, it felt like I want to keep her with me. I just don't want that name foregrounded. So that became my middle name. And recently, in the past several years, I felt like I would like to talk to her a little bit and sort of show her around my life. And there is always this question for me of, did I make her proud? Is she sitting there, this kid in high school who was sort of, a butch tomboy in the South, a little scrappy, is she feeling like, yeah, this was worth it. This is what we were shooting for.
Well, let's hear the poem Dear Melissa by Tiger Cakes Melissa Tolbert.
All right. Dear Melissa, I wish you, my mother once told me, mother of my childhood, even though water is water weary, what is prayer if not quiet? Who has made me? What hands you become when you touch? Who laid down on whose body? Whose face and whose shoulders worth shaking? What will I not hear when I look back at you? Who is not the mother of a daughter? Who is not the mother of a man? We are right to be afraid of our bodies. Wind is carried by what is upright and still moves what had been buried deep enough in the ground to be called roots. When will this be the world where you stop? Whatever broke into you was torn by the contact. A face wears a face it can see. What is alive is unrecognizable. Need it be? Who is my mother, mother? No one. Who hasn't killed herself by growing into someone? I'm sorry you have never been born.
My guest is T.C. Tolbert, who is the Poet Laureate of Tucson, Arizona, and also the curator for Poem of the Day for the American Academy, the Academy of American Poets, excuse me. So, T.C., how did you go about curating Poem of the Day for January? January is your month.
It's my month. I actually love that you said that, because the temptation and sort of my fear, honestly, when I was asked, would I like to curate this, is that I would somehow be sort of so afraid that it was like about me, that I wouldn't really drop into my values, and let's see, and and pay close attention that I want, because I would just be scared. Mm-hmm. Because it's such a big platform and it feels like such a big job. And I had been the co-editor for a transgender anthology, Troubling the Line, which was the first trans anthology of poetry. And I knew what attention and work it took to choose. And honestly, I'm the person who I want to open my arms as wide as I can and let as many people in through the door. And so the idea that I could only pick 23 poems really felt daunting. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one of the ways that I really approached it was to say, okay, you know, who am I not seeing represented in major publications? Who am I reading who I know is absolutely brilliant, but is simply not getting the exposure that they deserve? And so I've taken this really as an opportunity to uplift people and writing and writers that I just deeply admire and I want to see more of. They'll want to see a greater reflection of my community and of people whose work broadens my understanding of the world. So, in particular, I've chosen to amplify queer, trans, non-binary folks, people of color, and writers who are often characterized as emerging. And I find that word kind of funny sometimes. I think it often gets conflated with young poets, and that may or may not be true. But I'm particularly thinking about folks who may not have a full-length collection published yet. And so I really wanted to uplift them and have them enter into this larger conversation.
Well, let me ask you about one of your poets, and then we will, one of your choices, and we'll play mm-hmm. a little bit of it. Kay Ulunde Barrett. Tell mm-hmm. us a little bit about Kay and why this was one of the poems you chose.
So Kay is transgender, is non-binary, Filipino or Filipinx, and they are a poet whose work has spoken to me for years, and I deeply appreciate the way that Kay brings an awareness of grief and joy. In sort of integrates that into a singular space. I also deeply appreciate the way that Kay's work is accessible while also really pushing at the limits of form and working, you know, in particular in this poem with this prose block, but with these dashes that are really trying to bridge these jumps between experiences. So the poem moves kind of quickly and feels deeply grounded to me.
T.C. Tolbert, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to end today's show with Kay's poem, While Looking at Photo Albums, by Kay Ulunde Barrett. T.C., thanks for all your work.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Kay Ulunde Barrett. This poem is called While Looking at Photo Albums, Christmas Eve, 2016. Before everyone died, in my family, first definition I learned was my mother's maiden name, Ulandai, which literally means of the rain. And biology books remind us the pouring has a pattern, has purpose. Namesake means release. For my mother, meant flee, meant leave, know exactly what parts of you slip away. Drained sediment of a body is how a single mama feels on the graveyard shift. Only God is awake is where my family banked itself. A life rooted in rosaries, like nuns in barricades, scream, people power. 1 out of 5 leave to a new country. The women in my family hone in my heart like checkpoints, which is what they know, which is like a halt, not to be confused for stop. Which is what happened to my ma's breath when she went home. For the last time, I didn't get to hold her hand as she died. I said I tried. Just translates to, I couldn't make it in time I tell myself, ocean salt and tear salt are one and the same. I press my eyes shut. Cup, ghost howl. Cheek splint wood worn, which is to say, learn to make myself a harbor. Anyway, once I saw a pamphlet that said, what to do when your parent is dead. I couldn't finish reading, but I doubt it informs the audience. What will happen? Which is to say, you will pour your...
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.